This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Monday's mass murder and suicide by 16-year-old Jeff Weiss has left the Red Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota in a state of disbelief and mourning. Investigators must now struggle to determine what motivated Weiss to take the lives of nine people and then kill himself in the worst school shooting since Columbine 6 years ago. The boy left no suicide note behind. His history, though, reveals a pattern of troubled behavior. As the community turns inward for support, we on the outside once again watch distressingly familiar images. Shocked families, telephoto shots of a shuttered school, vigils at hospitals and at the state capitol, but this time in the new context of a sovereign reservation. Today, an update on what we know about the incident and its relationship to other school shootings, also reaction from the Native American community. Later in the program, revised figures project that Social Security and Medicare will go broke a year earlier than previously thought. But first, the tragedy in Red Lake. If you have questions about what happened, give us a call. If you're a parent or a teacher, what's changed at your school since Columbine? And we welcome calls from our Native American listeners. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin by turning to Robin Washington of the Duluth News Tribune and a contributor to National Native News. He's with us by phone from Bemidji, Minnesota, a town about 20 miles south of the Red Lake Reservation. Nice of you to be with us today on Talk of the Nation.
My pleasure, Neil.
Is there any news today, any update on what's happened?
There's, of course, everyone is still searching for motive, and we know that we still don't know that. I don't know that I recall that news. It's a little concern, actually. I noticed AP just moved a story, and I was working similarly on it, of some family members expressing a little frustration that they're not able to talk to the press, that the tribal leaders have actually told them not to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, of course, that doesn't bring us any directly closer to motive or anything like that, but obviously talking to people for some can be a relief and a release, rather. And, you know, we'll see. That's a concern that's one that's out there.
Yeah, the reservation, as I understand it, has tightened its borders. Now, of course, reservations maintain sovereign status. But what does that mean in this context, and how is that affecting access?
Yeah, I mean, and this is a closed reservation. It's by that, it means that, for instance, Minnesota state troopers don't have jurisdiction there. And in this case, although I'm sure that anybody is invited to help, they don't. This is the tribal police, and most importantly, it's the FBI and the Bureau of Indian Affairs Police. So they basically have their own government. They have their own courts. They have their own law enforcement. That only changes when something happens on a federal level that trumps it. And, of course, in this case, it certainly did.
So the FBI is in charge of the investigation?
Yes, it's been the lead agency so far. Right.
And are they working with the tribal police, I assume?
Right. Bureau of Indian Affairs is around, and any number of Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Mm-hmm. I understand that earlier today you spoke with tribal communicators. They're, I guess, the mouthpiece of the reservation to the outside world?
Well, briefly, he was on his way to a meeting that pretty much has been reported all morning of teachers and counselors figuring out what they need to do next. But, yeah, that's another thing that's, I hate to say, typical of many nations, but you may have the official voice of the tribe, and then there's unofficial voices, too. So there's a Ojibwe News is a newspaper that's independent, and then there's the Red Lake Net. There's an online service that's mm-hmm. Part of the tribe, so it's, you know, controlled by the nation.
Has there been any update on the condition of those who were injured in the incident?
I believe there's four who are still remain in the hospital. I don't know their conditions, though.
No. Okay. Have you been able to get on the reservation, you and other reporters?
Yeah, and that goes back to being closed. I mean, closed is more of a state of mind. It's sort of like you can enter parts of Canada, I suppose, without anybody noticing it, you know. So there's definitely a sign that greets you to the reservation. And you can drive on there, you can walk around. Clearly, you're not going to go to the school. If there's a roadblock, it's the horses are set up all in the school area, and there's obvious places not to go because the investigation is continuing. That said, that doesn't mean you just sit on the street and talk to people. A couple of photographers found that out yesterday when they were arrested, And again, the tribal police is the authority. So, you know, it's you may know your usual freedom of speech or First Amendment laws. So they might be interpreted slightly different when it's a different jurisdiction.
And the people that you have been able to talk to, what is their reaction? What are they thinking about?
Mournfulness is the main thing. It's, you know, how the same thing you hear anywhere. Of course, how could it happen here? That being said, the conditions on the reservation, you know, really demand a lot of attention in a strange way. That may be something that comes out of this that could work towards something positive. It's a place that's about 40% unemployment. High school graduation rate is about 60%. You know, it needs a lot of help. I have to say it opened up my eyes a bit. I've been covering the casino issue here in Minnesota, where there's a proposal to have a large casino in the Twin Cities, which is a lucrative area, that the Red Lake Nation would be a part of. And certainly if you see the reservation, you understand there are needs and wants, needs that they have that would be served by that. That's a very complicated statewide issue, but it does show that there's definitely a need for some infusion of funds.
Yeah, and those of us on the outside, again, I guess the new stereotype of Indian reservations is they're flush with gambling money, not always the case.
In a weird way, you know, this is maybe people can see that stereotypes don't always apply. You know, in this case, there is a casino, but it's nothing like the, of course, you have in New England, you have Foxwoods, Mohegan Sun, which are palaces. You're not going to find that here. You have others in Minnesota that do quite well. But it's a disparity around the state, and basically those in, for the most part, those in the urban areas do much better than obviously out here in Red Lake. I mean, it's, you're going to have to travel pretty far to get here, and there's not going to be a whole bunch of hotels and things, and certainly not Vegas-type entertainment for you.
Yeah. Robin Washington, thanks very much for taking the time. We know you're busy.
You're quite welcome.
Robin Washington is editorial page editor for the Duluth News Tribune and a contributor to National Native News. He joined us by phone from Bemidji, Minnesota. As the Native community reacts to Monday's shootings, the questions keep coming up about how this tragedy may impact wider perceptions of Native Americans and reservation life. Joining us now is Patty Talahongva, producer and host of the public radio talk show Native America Calling, and she comes to us from a studio at member station KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Patty, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
I know you finished up your own talk show just, 15 minutes ago, which focused on what happened in Red Lake. What were you hearing today from your audience?
A lot of concern, you know, a lot of condolences from Native people across the country, also from Canada as well. People wanting to let the Native people of Red Lake know that they are praying for them, and not just for the victims at the school or the grandparents and such, but also of the young man, the shooter, Jeffrey Weiss. And so the sympathy there and the prayers and the hope for healing of this community, definitely a big part of our show today.
There has been speculation, and again, it's not been confirmed, but widely publicized speculation that Jeffrey Weiss posted to Nazi websites. Has that come up at all?
No, we didn't get into that aspect because, again, it's speculation. I don't know if he truly was behind some of that. Mm-hmm. And the implications there, it's very interesting. The young man, you know, who obviously was very troubled in his life and felt no one around to talk to and express his emotions and his anger, frustration, whatever it was. So we did not get into that. The focus of the show was to look at the healing of the community because that's an important part of all of this. The shock that they have, you know, it's just been not even, 48 hours yet, you know, really. But I spoke with tribal members yesterday afternoon, and they were literally just exhausted because no one had slept in 24 hours. Neil, I would like to address a few things that you talked to just prior to bringing me into the program here.
With Robin, yeah.
With Robin, as far as the jurisdiction is concerned, that's one thing that I believe that America does not quite understand when it comes to Native people, but we are sovereign nations. Our reservations are basically nations within the United States, and so therefore we have our own tribal police departments and such, and when any non-Native person, tribal member comes onto the reservation, you are under the jurisdiction of that tribe's law enforcement. Now, whether you're a reporter or a visitor, a tourist, or whomever, you have to obey the laws of that nation. And the best way I can explain it is, when you go on to an Indian reservation, yes, it may be in the middle of Minnesota somewhere, but you should act as if you are going to Sweden, as if you're going to Ireland. You're in a different country, and you're under different laws. And so, no, the United States Constitution would not apply. The First Amendment laws would not apply. You need to respect the laws of that sovereign tribal nation.
It's important to understand not only the context of this story, but in the context of understanding Native American issues.
Yes, and the other thing is, again, this idea about, in covering the story itself, I'm not sure how economics even plays a factor in this, because as Columbine showed, if you come from an affluent society, you know, a family and such, it didn't stop that person. It didn't prevent a shooting in that community. So in the case of the Red Lake people, yes, there's a high unemployment rate and such, and no, they're not flush with casino money like a lot of tribes are. That's another misconception there, because most tribes in this country don't have casinos, and even the ones who do aren't all getting rich and rolling in the dough. So as far as economics go, it's a different story. You know, this, I think the bigger issue is the social issue of how did this person come to be in the position he was in to commit such a horrific crime.
Because obviously an awful lot of kids went through Red Lake High School and didn't shoot anybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hang with us, Patty. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll start taking phone calls. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. We're talking about reactions to Monday's shooting rampage in Minnesota. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the mass murder-suicide on the Red Lake Reservation Monday. A 16-year-old boy killed 9 people before taking his own life in a rampage that evokes memories of Columbine and other school shootings. Of course, you're invited to join our conversation. If you have questions about what we've learned or still don't know about this kind of crime, or about how security in your school district has changed in the years since Columbine, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking right now with Patty Talahongva, producer and host of Native America Calling. And let's go to the phones. Margaret's with us. Margaret's calling from Minneapolis. Margaret, are you there? Hello, Margaret. Margaret, one more time. I guess Margaret is not there. We thank her for her call. Let's go instead to Stacy, and Stacy's with us from Hamilton, New Jersey.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a teacher, and I teach in a high school with 320-some-odd students. And I'm always intrigued when acts of violence happen and people think a child is isolated. And I wonder what schools are doing to curb that isolation. I don't think that we have that problem at my school, and I think we actively work to avoid it. And I'm sort of perplexed that other schools don't make a notable effort. You know when a kid in your room is isolated and unhappy, and if you don't know, I think the school has a real problem. And so I'm interested in what other people think of that particular element.
And what is your school doing to try to counter this?
Well, among other things, it's an independent school, so we have the opportunity to sort of determine who comes to the school. But also, I think you foster a culture of caring. You ensure that the students feel responsible for one another. You treat them with respect, and you treat them as equals in pursuit of an education. And you don't allow cruelty or unkindness to pass. If it's in the hallways, if it's in your classroom, if it's in the lunchroom, and someone treats another student in a way that you know is unkind, you put a stop to it.
Well, we'll encourage calls from other people in other schools around the country to call in and say what's happening there. Good point, Stacy.
Thanks a lot.
Patty?
Neil?
Yes.
Oh, I just wanted to mention that one of our callers on my program mentioned the very same thing. She was a parent, and she said she encouraged other parents that if your child is popular in school, to reach out to the ones who are not as popular and to not join in with the group teasing somebody for being overweight or for being different in whatever way. You know, maybe they come from a poor family or a single-parent home or whatever. But she really encouraged that reaching out by your own children who are popular, because I think we also know as parents, you know, when our kids are well liked at school. So that was really interesting, that compassion there again, and looking at how our children can help each other out.
Is there any way to generalize? We understand at this reservation, the high school would have had fewer resources, perhaps, than other high schools in other situations. Around on reservations in general, does money flow to? Do high schools have the resources of high schools not on the reservation?
That's a really good question, because when we talk about the funding aspect, whether you're a BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs school, or a public school, or some sort of charter program school, the funding is always a big issue, and especially when it comes to reservation schools. And I know we've done a lot of shows with education, and the concern they teachers have, educators have, in Native country about the No Child Left Behind Act and how it's not funding tribal schools because the funds are going to the state and not to tribes specifically. And so the need there is quite large. And then, of course, the cutbacks. We had a show just yesterday on tribal colleges, and one is closing simply because they don't have enough money. So, yes, there's a problem there when it comes to funding schools on reservations in terms of just not academics, but also things like counseling and other aspects of school.
Let's get another caller on the line. Leon. Leon's calling from Mays Landing in New Jersey.
Hi, yes. My question is that in the early 1900s, the government was taking Native Americans from their homes and everything. And could this have an impact on today as far as the death of a culture?
And you're talking about the program that took, Jim Thorpe, I guess, is a famous example.
Yeah, well, and as I am a Navajo Indian, and I'm struggling with a cultural identity. And so could this be part of the reason?
Patty.
Well, I would say that, yes, you talk to any of our tribal members, and they look at the survival, the fight to survive as a Native culture, whichever culture you come from. And, yes, there was a huge break in that cultural tie when we were taken off to boarding schools, and whole generations were lost as far as understanding the language and the culture and such. And then the people then coming back and saying, we want to reclaim this, the language, the ceremonies, everything. And so the breaking of that culture is very tragic, and it's happened to every single Indian people in this country and in Canada, our people across the border in Mexico. So, but reclaiming that, because the other thought in Indian country is that no matter what's happened, our people have survived and they've gone on. They have found the way to continue on as Native people. But how does that impact our generations today, you know, the loss of the language, the culture, and such? And on that note, too, I spoke with a tribal council member prior to my show. He was affected personally by the shootings, and so declined to be on our program. But he did share with me that tonight the community is coming together, and they're calling all of their traditional drum groups to meet this evening and to have a prayer and singing session this evening so that the people can come together and again start that process of healing and just letting go and dealing with the grief that they have here.
But again, this cultural impact hits everybody in the Native American community. Obviously, everybody in the Native American community does not go out and start shooting people.
Yes, you have to look at that aspect as well.
Leon, thanks very much for the phone call.
And thank you very much, and I will send my healing energy your way.
Thanks again. Let's talk now with Sam. Sam is with us from Tallahassee.
Hey, Neil. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
This is just sheer coincidence. I'm an English teacher, college level, and just last week I showed a video to my class that I show every semester when I do a unit on gender, and the name of the video is Jackson Katz's Tough Guys, and it looks at violence and male masculinity and culture. And he spends a significant amount of time on the school shootings on Littleton and Columbine. And one of the things he points out that never gets discussed is these are all boys committing these crimes. And certainly, as you and your guest pointed out, not everybody that's teased does commit these acts, but everybody that's committed these acts happens to be boys. And one of the things that Katz points out is that in all of these conversations, we're not looking at this. We're not looking at how much of the influence of what it is to be tough in society and what you have to do to stand up for yourself. And so when you get kids that are being picked on, and again, they tend to be the boys that have to find ways to express their aggression or to fight back or to be tough. And I'm just wondering if you and your guests have anything to say to that. And
well,
obviously it transcends class and social class and ethnicity and in this case.
Well, one of the reasons we're trying to be so cautious about what may have motivated Jeffrey Weiss is that this long after Columbine, we thought exactly what you were saying, Sam, that this was teasing and that this was a reaction to that. We learned later that that was wrong. That was not the motive for the Columbine shootings, that there was a considerably more involved than that, but it was not a reaction. It was a desire for fame. One of the kids was subsequently diagnosed as a sociopath. So that's why you have to be so careful about this.
Yeah, and one or two cases where they were, but in overwhelmingly, though, there were a lot of cases. The Jonestown, or the, was it Jonesboro, Arkansas? I can't remember. Jonesboro.
Jonestown is something completely different.
Jonestown, well,
even worse, but different.
Right, that was another place in time, but the Jonesboro incident. But that does tend to be, again, basically what Katz is saying is that they all are boys that are doing this. You don't see that girls are doing this, and I'm just wondering if your guest has any comment to that.
Patty?
Well, that's a almost a frightening thought as far as looking at who's capable. You know, I guess anyone would be capable if the circumstances are all in place there. But it as far as the male aspect goes, a lot of thought has been put into how the male Native person deals with society today and how they're, again, the disconnect between the cultural aspect and how they're defined as a Native person, a Native man, is so different than what is defined as a Native man today. So it's interesting to think about that, and I'm kind of at a loss to think, you know, out loud even more about Jeffrey Weiss, because I don't know this young man. I don't know outside of his family circumstances what motivated him or what was going through his mind. And there's a lot, it's going to take a lot of time before all of this, the investigation settles down and some information is brought forward here. But I do want to say that, again, back to our program, we had a man from the First Cree Nation in Canada, and he talked about how important it is, no matter what it is, a tragedy that you're dealing with or, you know, just situations in everyday life, but that in order to grieve, in order to cry, if you're affected by something, that is okay, that you're not less of a man to do that. And he talked about, again, Creator giving us the tear ducts and the tears coming from our physical body. And they're put there for a reason. So cry and let that emotion out. And whether, again, it doesn't have to be just at a tragedy like this, a funeral, but in whatever way you're hurting, that you allow yourself to grieve and nobody thinks less of you. So this idea of strong man or this idea of a stoic Indian man, no, you know, let yourself grieve and then from that heal and move on.
Sam, thanks for the call.
Sure.
And Patty, before we let you go, I wonder, as far as what you're seeing, is mainstream media treating this subject differently than Native news outlets?
Well, it's interesting. I haven't had a chance to watch every single mainstream media report and such, but a couple of things came up. And of course, you know, that's a difficult situation because obviously it's news. Obviously, mm-hmm. News outlets want to cover this. But a couple of things I heard last night. One was a report, and the opening line was a trail of tears in Red Lake. And I'm sitting with my Native friend, and we're both cringing, saying, oh, please don't go there. Don't reduce this to cliches or, you know, especially if you don't know the history behind what happened with the Trail of Tears. You know, the comparison there is not, it's not good. No, and so the coverage and the aspect, you know, the tribe itself and trying to deal with the onslaught of media there, it's very difficult. And the respect that the media has for the families and for the reservation itself, I think it's a learning process here and understanding again that this is a sovereign nation with any family. when you're walking into a situation where they're grieving after such a tragedy, how do you treat them respectfully and carefully and not cross that boundary? So I've seen a couple of reports that just make me cringe. As far as the native media goes, I know that this is huge news within Indian country. So how do we get that word out? And I think part of that process is talking with the tribal leadership there. And I know that they, in fact, we had on our show Holly Cook, who is a tribal member, and she lives and works in Washington, D.C., but was called back to help out specifically with the media there. So she was able to join us on our program and obviously has been quite affected by everything that's happened there in her hometown. But it's one way that the tribe is reaching out to try to accommodate the media requests.
Patty, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Patty Talahongva is producer and host of Native America Calling and joined us from the studios of member station KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And in mentioning Monday's shootings, of course, we recall Columbine 6 years ago in Jonesboro. Sociologist Catherine Newman has examined cases of this type of mass violence and reminds us that the first thing we have to remember is they are extremely rare. She's a professor at Princeton University, the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, and she joins us now from NPR's Bureau in New York City. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure, Neil. Thank you.
Now, you've studied specific cases of what you term rampage shootings. How is this type of teen violence unique?
Well, it is thankfully very rare, and it is a subset of homicides in which you have a shooter who belongs to an institution like a school shooting in a fairly random fashion. That is one of the important aspects of school shootings. They are not revenge killings directed at particular individuals, or they don't stop there, even if they might begin there. They are attacks on institutions and on whole groups of people whom the shooter wants to attract attention from and reorient his public reputation toward. So these are very special kinds of incidents that involve multiple homicides. They are quite different from revenge shootings, which we might see happen in urban areas. Rampage school shootings of this kind never happen in big cities. We haven't had a single incident of that kind in a big city, even though, of course, there's a great deal of background violence in big cities. But rampage shootings of this kind happen in small, remote, rural areas and in suburban communities.
One, obviously, at the end of this incident, the young man committed suicide. At least that's what we believe at this point. Is that common?
Yes, it's common to have suicidal impulses. Whether or not suicide actually takes place varies from case to case. But we do see, especially among the survivors, because we can interview them, evidence backtracking of suicidal impulses and extreme depression bordering on serious mental illness, which if they live long enough becomes more florid and recognizable into their 20s. It's very difficult to identify these mental disorders in young men 13, 14 years old, which was the age of the shooters I studied.
Mm-hmm. Obviously detecting these sorts of things in teenagers is always difficult.
Extremely difficult. And the one conclusion we drew in the book, which the Secret Service came to as well, is that we will never be able to predict who will become a school shooter. Our best bet for stopping these horrible tragedies in their tracks is to try to interdict a large amount of information, threats, veiled commentary circulating in advance, which peers have usually heard. And that seems to have been the case in this instance as well. But peers tend not to come forward. Adolescents tend not to come forward and tell adults. And I think our best bet for doing anything to stop this lies in making it easier for adolescents to come forward and tell what they've heard.
Briefly, we just have a few seconds left in the segment. You said the Secret Service, they protect the president. What's their interest in this?
The Secret Service is in the business of trying to profile rare events, rare violent events, and so they have actually looked at school shootings and have come to the conclusion that you cannot profile a school shooter. They come from good families and dysfunctional families. They are often very strong students. They almost never have a disciplinary record behind them. They are not the squeaky wheels that bring down the attention of schools in the form of disciplinary apparatus, and so we don't track them and we don't see them coming.
Stay with us, Catherine Newman. We're going to take a short break and then continue our discussion about the roots, as best we know, of these kinds of school shootings, and also look at new projections for how long Medicare and Social Security can remain solvent. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're discussing the case of the Minnesota teenager who killed his grandfather and a companion before opening fire at his school on Monday. Jeff Weiss's final acts of violence against other students and then himself put him in the rare and horrific company of other school shooters. Our guest is Catherine Newman, professor of sociology at Princeton University, who studied these kinds of cases. And let's get a caller on the line. Steve joins us. Steve's calling from Toledo, Ohio.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I just had a quick comment. When Columbine happened several years ago, I was a senior in high school. And the way that our high school dealt with it, we went to a suburban high school just north of here, was that they kind of rounded up everybody that they thought didn't fit into the mold, and we all had to go through a series of interviews and stuff. And it was pretty bizarre. You know, anybody with long hair or mohawks or anything like that, they kind of rounded up and made us all talk to them about whether or not we were dangerous.
Anybody who wore black?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Is that sort of thing, Catherine Newman, in your experience, is that useful?
No, I think it's more useful for schools to treat the whole school, so to speak, and to try to raise the awareness of students that the common, ordinary, adolescent pecking order behavior can have horrendous consequences. Rounding up particular individuals who look in a certain way isn't going to tell you a thing about a likely school shooter. And it tends to compartmentalize what is really a much broader problem, which is the way teenagers treat one another. It is a pretty tough age group to be part of, and many of us adults can remember back and wouldn't trade places with teenagers for a moment because it is a rough period of time. So I think it's probably not very helpful. That said, schools are understandably nervous. They are held responsible. And they want to be proactive. Sometimes they want to know whether or not kids who look in unorthodox ways are unhappy, and they're trying to find out if there are problems that they're unaware of, because there frequently are. But I don't think singling out kids who look in a certain fashion is likely to get us anywhere.
Yeah. Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk now with Bill Full, the president-elect of the National Association of School Psychologists, people who are on the front lines of these issues, and he joins us by phone from his home in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Nice of you to join us today.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to mention a team of psychologists from your organization is now headed to Bemidji, Minnesota?
They're headed to the Red Lake Reservation. Yes, they are. Three of our National Emergency Assistance Team members are there and should arrive sometime this evening.
At the invitation of the tribal?
It's at the invitation of the tribal elders, as also the superintendent of the public schools there, or at the school on the reservation.
Okay. Well, how has the job of school psychologists changed since Columbine?
Oh, the job of the school psychologist has changed immensely, from mostly looking and dealing with disabilities and handicapping conditions to actually being a full-service provider, including crisis response, as we have in this case.
We were just talking with Catherine Newman about the difficulty of identifying these kids, who, to begin with, are very rare to start. So is there any evidence that you can find, identify these kids before something awful like this happens?
It's really a very difficult task to do that. If we had to identify anybody who ever made a threat in school, we'd have to round up many, many students, and probably for naught. It really is a school-wide effort, and I think that's the message from Columbine, is to provide a full range of people available to students to have an active, safe school plan and to have an active way to look at students that may have made a threat or be involved. Not the idea that was just put forth by your caller of just rounding students up and questioning them. Those, as I agree with Ms. Newman, that this is not productive.
Let's get another caller on the line and talk with Tricia, who's calling from Morrisville, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Hi, Tricia.
I'm a board member in Morrisville, Pennsylvania. We're a very small school system of about 1,000 kids total. And I've been on the board for 4 years now. And I honestly don't know what all the answers are, other than there's, you know, certainly societal issues. And, you know, the big issue that I think hasn't been talked about is access to guns. and that people need to be aware of how devastating that can be. But
again, Tricia, though, there's an awful lot of kids who have access to guns who don't do this.
Yes, that's true. I agree with that. And that said, I think several things to keep in mind for school systems. As a caller had asked earlier, what can people do? I think, one, never assume it can't happen here. And what we've tried to do within our school system in our approach to behavior management is to really create a culture where kids feel safe and respected, and there's an atmosphere of mutual respect. Certainly anti-bullying programs are helpful. Many of the schools where these things have occurred, we learned, had major security systems in place, and yet, you know, that did not prevent things from occurring. So I think it's...
Catherine Newman, is that right?
No, it really isn't, because the kinds of places where these events happen are usually, again, small, often rural communities that don't have background violence problems. Their biggest worry is whether the school bus is going to arrive on time. So they tend not to have the metal detectors and security guards that you typically see in urban areas. So I'm afraid I don't think that that's quite right.
Red Lake High did have a security guard and metal detectors. But Tricia, I'm sorry.
I know that some of the shootings that have occurred with guards and so on in place. You know, perhaps many was not the appropriate statement, but I, you know, what we did learn in looking at what we could do locally and within our system is that it seems to be that the most important thing is creating an atmosphere where the kids feel safe enough to come forward if they do hear things that they're uncomfortable with, that in many cases... things were said and nobody responded proactively.
Bill Full, let's bring you in on this. Is that a positive approach?
It really is a positive approach, is reaching out to students and letting them know that we care about them. As you said earlier, this is a tough time for any adolescent and even younger. So reaching out and letting students know that somebody cares and will listen to them is critical.
Tricia, thank you very much, and you said earlier you certainly don't have all the answers. Join the club. I don't think anybody has all the answers.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. I wanted to ask you, Catherine Newman, as you look at these cases, do they feed off each other? Are the teens you looked at, were they very interested in other school shootings?
They were around Columbine. I think we have to recognize that 6 years is a very long time in the lives of today's adolescents. So the kids in Red Lake who are 15 years old today were fairly young when Columbine happened, and their knowledge of it is probably fairly remote. I do think this will become a new template. Certainly immediately after Columbine, it was clear that there were many copycat incidents, some that were averted precisely because the media did let people know what had happened, and then kids who heard threats started to come forward more readily once they knew they were hearing a kind of script for a future school shooting. There were some spectacular near misses in New Medford, Massachusetts, and other places which could have been on the same scale as the Red Lake episode, but because kids knew something like this really could happen, which they didn't really register before Columbine, they came forward. But I think we do have to understand 6 years is a long time, and if we don't let our young people know that these things can happen, and as your caller said, provide them an atmosphere where they feel comfortable coming forward, unfortunately we could see copycat incidents of this kind happen in clusters.
Bill Full, I meant to ask you, as you look at your job as a president-elect of the National Association of School Psychologists, I assume that after Columbine, a lot of resources in many high schools were devoted to this problem. Am I incorrect in assuming further that after 9/11, some of those resources may have been diverted to other purposes?
Yes, that's really possible. Those schools in general, after Columbine, really did start to consolidate information. And what the National Association of School Psychologists did is we kind of incorporated what we had learned from Columbine into helping schools deal with the terrorists. So we learned a lot along the way, and we continue to learn a lot, in kind of melding these together and what's best for children.
And what's the biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge is really getting people to believe this can happen. As mentioned earlier, a lot of people still don't believe it can happen in their school community, that we have a nice community, we're safe. But these incidents, unfortunately, can happen anywhere.
And before we let you go, Catherine Newman, I did want to ask you as well. Obviously, this incident just happened Monday. We don't know why yet. Many details have yet to emerge. But as you look at this on the basis of the information of what we know now, does it fit the pattern of the school shootings that you've studied?
More or less to a T. It was shockingly familiar to me, really down to the last details. And, of course, we'll all be interested in the coverage that comes forth hereafter. My guess is that the Native American element of this will not turn out to be the most profound causal pathway. What this shooting has in common with the many others we've studied is that it took place in a small, rural, isolated area, that it involved a kid who was not a loner, contrary to the press, but instead was what I would call a failed joiner, someone who was attempting to ingratiate himself into groups. After all, this kid did tell people in a joking way what he was thinking of doing. He showed kids his drawings. There's already evidence that he was attempting, in many instances, to curry favor or gain attention, and that is absolutely what we found in the school shootings we looked at. And it's crucial to understand that element because what the shooter is trying to do is change the way people see him. They're trying to be redefined as notorious, dangerous, and cool rather than nerdy and geeky and socially unacceptable to their peers.
Catherine Newman, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Catherine Newman, the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, a professor of sociology at Princeton, joined us from our bureau in New York. And Bill Fold, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you very much.
Bill Fold is president-elect of the National Association of School Psychologists. He joined us by phone from his home in Bowling Green, Kentucky.